Hi folks, I'm Cynthia Dearen and welcome to Business Beyond Borders, where we unlock the secrets of international business success. In each episode, I talk to an entrepreneur who's expanded their business beyond the borders of their own country about how they did it. And in this episode, I'm talking to Justin Hilditch, who's a financial services guy and an expert in the financial markets. Justin has worked around the world, in New York, in London, in Asia and in Australia with some of the biggest names in the game, Morgan Stanley, Bear Stearns, Deutsche Bank and ANZ Bank right here in Australia. But these days he runs Thames Capital, which is headquartered in Sydney and serves clients in Australia and a bunch of other places as well. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. Happy to be here.
You're originally from the UK, but now you run a company that serves international clients and you do it from Australia. How did that happen?
I'm not sure, to be honest. It didn't actually set out that way when I first started the business. So I've been in Australia probably since around 2004. I had a job with a bank in London and was due to move to Tokyo with them. And then an opportunity came up and they said, do you want to do the same job but from Australia? And I said, yep, perfect, I'm in. So I moved over then and I've been kind of in Australia on and off ever since. I think more recently in the latter years of banking, as much as I enjoyed my career, I was looking to try and do something different, a bit more on my own. But I really struggled to find out what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to keep that international connection going with my past networks, particularly in London, particularly in New York. And obviously given the scalability of business that happens in on that level overseas, I thought it was a great thing to try and marry up some of the financial pieces with the international piece and do it on my own. So I think living in Australia, you have to tap the international markets and what we do. And I think that works very, very well to allow us to really get involved there.
And was there something in particular that prompted you to step out of the corporate world and do your own thing? Was there some epiphany that you had or something in particular that transpired that made you make that decision?
Not massively. I mean, I didn't kind of wake up one day and go, right, that's it. I've had enough of banking. I'm moving out. It was more, I think, you know, I guess turning 40, what did I want to do? Where did I want to be with my career? It was a bit of a now or never moment. I think the, you know, ever since the GFC, the markets have been up and down. I think that the general way that the global markets work, for me, was getting a little bit stale in what I was doing. So I really wanted to try and branch out and it was the perfect time for me to do that. So, I think what I've always struggled with is trying to find what field to do it in. That was the problem. But I just think the frustration of wanting to get more out of life really pushed that. And it was perfect timing at the time. I just finished up what I was trying to do in one particular business. And then, you know, the planets aligned and I left probably in March 2016. And set up the business a couple of months later.
So if you think back to when you were a child, did you have aspirations to work internationally or was this just something that kind of popped up later on?
Well, not really. I mean, I grew up in a military family. So every couple of years we moved to a new country. And it was just something that I encountered from a very young age. It wasn't probably till I got to almost university age that I realized I was probably not normal compared to all the other people who weren't in military families. So by default, that's kind of always happened. And obviously when you move into banking, there's a lot of opportunities to move jobs, which means you can move countries as well. And it was something I always like to try and expand where I can into different skill sets or different cultures. And the opportunity came up very early on in my career to move from London to New York. So I took that and then another job moved me back to London. So I kind of moved where the opportunities were and used the international piece just as something I didn't see as a barrier at the time. So that worked very well. Moving around. In hindsight, I probably moved a bit too much, but from country to country, but it's something I've done my entire life. So it's not really that alien. I've probably been in Australia longer than I have anywhere else right now. But so I think you get that thirst for moving around. I think international business and the travel that comes with it is just incredible.
Let's talk about what you're doing now. Tell me what Thames Capital does. What problems do you solve for your clients?
So we're a boutique corporate advisory business and we have an alternative investment management firm with that and also a complementary consulting business. So that's a bit of a mouthful, so I'll break it down into a few different parts. We have two main companies and within those companies we have two business lines. The first company is Thames Capital Advisory, which is your traditional corporate advisory work, which focuses very heavily on helping companies who are looking to possibly expand very much more on kind of a mergers and acquisitions, capital structuring, debt advisory type mandate. So this is established companies who are looking to maybe acquire another business or need help with their balance sheets. And as another part of their business as well, we have what we call an alternative investment management business. They're both regulated by ASIC, as we have an Australian Financial Services License. And that business focuses very much on looking after wholesale clients, advising them where to put their money. It differs slightly from a financial planning firm in that we look purely at the investment spectrum. We don't look at anything to do with mortgages. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just not our level of expertise. So we look very much on the alternative markets. We find we can develop portfolios that clients like to give them blended access of risk versus reward. And then we also have another business, which is under the Thames Capital Consulting arm, which is split into two separate sections. And the reason it's split is purely around clients. So the clients we have on the consulting side tend to be larger institutions, banks, hedge funds, insurance companies, and mutuals who are maybe trying to redevelop some of their structure within inside their business. So more around, structuring, changing client channels, looking at individual sales processes. And then the business advisory arm of that works much more, I guess, at the smaller end of town for the small to medium-sized businesses who are looking to expand, potentially need some help with strategies and implementation around going from an owner to a manager, taking on new staff, particularly from a compliance perspective, and looking at the general strategy for business growth. So that's kind of very much more hands-on, if you like, on the smaller business side. So they're the kind of two businesses, four parts.
Okay. And I mentioned in the intro that you work with a lot of foreign clients, and as I understand it, some of those are pretty big. Now, I don't want you to give away any secrets, obviously, but can you tell me what clients these big foreign clients are? What kind of companies are these, and how were you actually able to get them as clients? So I'm really interested to understand how it was that you were able to convince large organizations on the other side of the world to work with you, given that when you started out, you were new and you were small.
Yeah, I think given the different types of businesses, we have different types of clients, obviously. So on the investment management side, Australia is very much considered to be a place hunting for yield, if you like. If you want to increase your yield in investment products, particularly in the VC space as well, venture capital. So we have a lot of clients who travel in from Europe and America into Australia, who we've met actually through trade shows or through word of mouth. We found that word of mouth and recommendations from past colleagues or from satisfied companies and individuals are incredibly powerful, particularly on the individual level. But with the much larger companies, a lot of them tend to have offices here and are maybe headquartered in Europe or America. Yeah. So if we do a good job for a company here and by nature of their management style, we'll be having conversations with people overseas. They've put us in touch with their global headquarters, and we've either had direct conversations and follow-ups there, or we've been recommended, and the people on the ground here have done a lot of work directly for us there. Given we have a lot of previous networks within the team from people who've worked in Europe and America particularly, and Asia, when we first set up the business, we started reaching out to those people very early on and saying, we're doing this. If the company in any way is looking to have help in these particular areas, we can help them on that. And, some of that was very much, we didn't hear from them for a year. Some of them haven't heard from at all. I think what's been very good in trying to get them interested is that we've had a lot of people, thankfully, who've helped us open doors, which we're forever grateful for. But the secondary piece, you then have to pitch. You have to, you're not selling yourself, you're selling your company. Effectively, taking that next step, making sure that people on the ground then know what you can do and your capabilities. And often that's face to face. So that's been a fair amount of travel. And we got hooked with one or two, and then from there, they've told other people, and we're gradually, we've still got a very long way to go, but we found that some of those prior networks have really helped us, just to give a quick check and solidify what we do.
And I'm sure that having those names like Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns and Deutsche Bank and ANZ next to your name couldn't really have hurt things too much. Would I be right?
No, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, the credentials still stack up. They've still got to figure out whether they like you or don't like you, I suppose. And whether, you know, whether the work that you did there, it does give you a track record, and it does give you an extra feather in your cap. But I would still say it hasn't necessarily opened as many doors as I thought it would. And that's probably a little bit of arrogance leaving banking and going into your own business.
Yeah, I think that can always come as a surprise to anybody who steps out of corporate and into their own thing, because suddenly rather than having that backing of an enormous brand, suddenly they're doing everything themselves, from the branding to the IT, yeah, to actually absolutely winning the work, to delivering the services. And it can be fairly, you know, it's definitely different.
Absolutely spot on. I think that was probably one of the hardest things that I certainly encountered, and certainly the same story you've had from people who've joined the team.
Yeah. If you think about those big international clients that we were talking about a moment ago, is there something in particular that you like about working with those large organizations that are elsewhere?
Yeah, I think what I like the most is the scale and global reach is an obvious conversation. Let me give you an example on that. So we had a client we've done a bit of work for before, not a huge amount. We've done little bits and pieces. You know, we can be in a situation, we had a conference call with them, you know, 9 o'clock at night in Australia, which is early morning in London, for example. And then effectively they've agreed to do some work. By the time we wake up the next day, the work had been done, or at least been started. So you, yes, kind of, you get that efficiency of when we're asleep, other people are working. When they're asleep, you're working. And if you, it doesn't always work like that, but if you get to a situation with clients in that space, that's incredibly powerful. And certainly when I was in the investment banking world, there was a lot of that that went on, probably not as efficient as it could have been, but I think more and more so now in a cost-conscious environment, people are doing that. And the world is, you know, has always been very global in its nature of work being done, but now so more than ever. And we found that to be very advantageous for us as a small team, a small business.
That's really, really, that's a very interesting observation. I want to talk a little bit now about mistakes that people make as they expand businesses internationally. And this, yeah, particularly came to mind because we were on a panel together recently. One of the topics that we touched on was the mistakes that people make as they actually expand their businesses overseas. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, you gave a couple of really phenomenal examples. And I was wondering whether you could share with our listeners what kind of mistakes you see clients making as they go global. I think that'd be fascinating.
Yeah, no problems. I think, well, firstly, I'd say lack of common sense. People in their own world, they look after their money, they look after their children, they make sensible decisions. I think when you get wedded to an idea in a business and it's gone particularly well in one country and you think, well, I'm now going to move overseas. So what I've got to do, I'm going to take my brand and do everything I did here that worked here, and then I'm going to go overseas and replicate it and do exactly the same thing. Mm. Possibly without enough research, possibly with not partnering on the ground. I'll come back to that in a minute. I think we referred to a company, I won't go into too many details, that had done phenomenally well here and decided to move to a European country, and pretty much used the same model. I think the big mistake they made, in which they lack knowledge, and they took an entire sales force from Australia, and they had English people speaking people who they took from the UK into a non-English speaking country and tried to basically sit on the ground. They bought an office, they had salespeople, phenomenal capital cost to set up. And we, through a colleague of another colleague, they said to us, you should have a look, they're having problems with their business. They've done really well here, but it doesn't seem to be going that well, you know, in this given country. So we had a look at the books, had a look at the business, and basically realized they hadn't made any sales, hadn't made any traction. And the first thing we said to them, well, what is your offering? What's the competition? What research did you do before you got on the ground?
And they said,
none. This is a super smart business. Yeah. And they'll do well. They've recovered from that. They've moved back and they'll start again. Mm. I think the most important thing that we learned from that, also looking at what they did, is you can never underestimate the power of the partnerships on the ground. And yeah, what I mean by that is, you know, you can spend an hour on Google and get a lot of information. You know, I'm not saying it's a thorough way of doing DD, but you can pretty much see what else is out there in a different country.
Yeah.
And then the overlay on top of that is very much who locally is doing what you're doing. Can you partner with them? Is there an aspect of your life cycle and the workflow that you can pick up and utilize with someone else and truly partner? So I'm not suggesting JVs and giving business away, but effectively someone who knows the environment, knows the culture, knows the people, knows what sells, what doesn't sell. Yes. because, you know, particularly from Australia, it is a remote part of the world. It doesn't mean in any way that it's not as sophisticated as anywhere else, but what sells here might not sell in another country, and that other country might not sell in another continent. So it's very much, you know, it's tricky moving overseas. It really is. And then, you know, to globally scale from there, it's tough.
Yeah. And what do you think, I mean, from the perspective of somebody who is advising international clients and really running an international company from Australia, what do you think is the most challenging thing? Is it the fact that we are far away from many of the other centers of business?
Yes, I think so. But I think that's also a massive benefit to people who live in Australia. I was always impressed when I came to Australia to realize that there's so many people who have a massive entrepreneurial bent. And I'm talking just in a regular work as well.
Yeah.
They're always looking for new ways, or looking at ways of, I guess it'd be called punching above the weight, or always looking for new ways of doing things. I mean, I personally think the hardest thing about running an international business is lack of sleep. But I think that's because you are so far away from everyone else and you have to work within that time zone as well. I think you've just got to be prepared to do what you wouldn't normally do. And that means your hours aren't 8 till 6. They're 8 till whenever. Or they're, it means you maybe don't start working your Australian job until 11 o'clock and you finish at midnight if you're doing a lot of work in that space. You've really got to become a lot more 24-hour. And I'm not suggesting you kill yourself to do that. There's mechanisms you can use. But I think being in Australia, you really have to put yourself out there. I mean, I don't think there's probably many businesses in Australia that don't have a global outreach. They might not see it, see themselves as an international business, but by default, they're either buying and selling in and out of other countries, or their product is being bought and sold out of other countries.
Yeah.
So I think you know, you're exactly right. The proximity of Australia to the rest of the world means you have to kind of get up and get out there.
Now, as you've just mentioned, sometimes things can be pretty tough when you are working these ridiculous hours and, you know, dealing with the expectations of people in other time zones and, you know, who maybe have preferences and requirements that are hard to gauge given how far away you are from them. When things are challenging like that, where do you get your inspiration from? You know, what is it? Where do you turn for your business inspiration?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I mean, there's always stories. You've only got a look on LinkedIn, and there's usually 50 stories of someone who's done phenomenally well for themselves, come from nothing and moved out and branched out. I don't know. I think it's very difficult. You know, moving around so much, you get to see, when I was younger, you got to see a lot of things that worked, a lot of things that failed, a lot of things that worked in one country but didn't work in another country. I would say wherever possible, your network is going to help you. I think you have to have a huge amount of tenacity, and also use your friends and family, use your ex-colleagues. Yeah. That's what they're there for. They're a network. They're the reason. I mean, you know, if you were to get a piece of paper and write down 10 names, whether it's friends or family, or whether it's work colleagues, you know pretty much who you can go to and who you can't go to. And I'd say be brave and be bold. I didn't do this myself early on. It took me a while to get into this, to ask for help and speak to people. But I think that network wants you to succeed as well, as much as you want to succeed.
That's a great point.
And when you speak to a lot of other people who are doing it, whether their bravado is there or whether their front is up, they're in the same boat as you are. They're petrified about making mistakes. They want to make sure the business works. They've got family commitments. And I think that's incredibly important to be able to utilize that network. So when I'm having a bad day or I think it's not going particularly right, I tend to try and go for a run. It tends to help. Or you speak to people who are going through the same thing. I mean, we work with a lot of startup companies as well, who are very heavily invested, and they are probably working much longer hours than I am on a shoestring and trying to make things work.
Yeah.
You've only got to look at anyone else around you to figure out, you know, people are doing it harder than you are. And I think you've got to keep pushing with it.
I love that. So there's a lot in there, I guess, about self-talk and the things that we tell ourselves about whether or not we can actually achieve the goals that we set for ourselves, particularly in that international business space, which can be so very challenging. Yeah. And speaking about challenges, I also wanted to ask you about the SAS course that you went on for 48 hours a few months ago. Yeah. Because I think this was somehow related to business, and I'd just like to know a bit about how that happened and a bit about, you know, what that course was about and what you learned from it, you know, and what you learned from it in terms of the things that we tell ourselves and, you know, where we can go when we think we actually can't go anywhere.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a bit of an experience. I've drawn a bit on that since I did it. Yeah. So basically we've been doing some kind of smaller end corporate advisory work with a company who had a couple of ex special forces guys who were in there. You know, I got talking to them one day about what they do, what they had ran a number of different businesses. And one of their businesses was they do resilience courses. And I thought, oh, fantastic. Well, I thought, well, I'll come on the resilience course and I'll bring some colleagues with me to come and do that. As it happened, of the 10 people I said to come and do it, who had probably read a bit more about it than I had, all dropped out. So I did it myself, along with a bunch of other people. And I ignorantly thought it was going to be a little bit of physical exercise, as you do military-wise, and a lot of kind of theory. In practice, it was the other way around. And it was 48 hours. I think I lost 5 kilos in a weekend, which was great before Christmas. But I think what it really taught me, I mean, I won't go into all the detail, but I wrote an article on LinkedIn and posted it there. So if anyone wants to read it, it's on there. But effectively, what it really taught me is stuff that's common sense. You have this, you get to a stage, you're 40 hours in, you've maybe had two effectively the same as Mars bars in the last 48 hours. You've done more exercise than you thought was possible for a human to do in the blazing sun, carrying a pack, it's hot, you're really uncomfortable, and your mind does play tricks with you all the time. So I'm going to quit now. I could be at home having a Sunday lunch with my family. I could be doing this. And then you keep going. And then you get through that exercise. And then the next exercise you do, you find out the person you started with is dying. They're in the same position you are, but you've got a bit more strength than they have. So you help them through that. 10 minutes later, you're struggling and almost dying. You can't move forward. They're helping you then. And if one person drops out through injury, then you have to rethink the whole dynamic. So I guess it is a resilience course, but in a very extreme way of doing it. And I take my hat off to anyone who's in the military who does that kind of thing, because it really is, it's tough, it's hard yards. But I think what I did realize coming out of that is that the essence of teamwork is absolutely essential in that world. It literally is a live or die situation. Not in what we're doing, but obviously the guys who are overseas and who are on dispatch. But effectively, for me, I learned that all the stuff I used to whinge about and say, oh, the train's not on time, or this coffee's rubbish, or I don't like this, didn't really matter anymore. Nothing mattered at all. And it meant that you could actually continue doing anything that you thought you could do. So a lot less whinging. Learned a lot of humility. I like to pride myself on a lot of stuff that I do. I try my best and make sure that I try and come in the top 10 if I can. I was very firmly at the back for probably at least a quarter of the weekend, if not more than that. And that was hard. You had to suck it up. It was tough. It was really tough mentally. And then no matter how hard you push to try and get near the front, you can't because you're not fit enough or you're not strong enough. We just kept going. So I think 30 people registered. I think 15 people started and 5 of us finished. So I was pretty happy with that.
Wow, but, that's pretty impressive.
Learned a lot. So I would say to anyone who's thinking about doing that, definitely try and do it. I would probably start building up to it by doing a 6-hour one, then a 12-hour one, then 24. Don't go straight into 48. But yeah, fantastic. It was a great, great experience.
What I think is really interesting about what you've just said is that I see so many parallels between that experience of being physically and mentally pushed over a period of 48 hours and the process that you go through when you launch a business or when you take your business overseas. You know, especially absolutely. With the things that you said about, you know, thinking that you just can't do it and your mind playing tricks on you. But as you force yourself to keep on going, you realize that actually, even though it seems so incredibly difficult, you really can do it if you just decide that you will and you can hang in there and you can make it through to the end.
Yeah. And I think the funniest thing about that is when I first started the business, I wasn't 100% sure it was going to work. And that's the last makes me think 100% in areas it's not going to work. But it's funny, for every 10 positive comments you've got, you only need one negative comment. And it's not the 10 positive comments you think about. It's the one negative one. And you're like, well, maybe they're right. They are right. That's what I thought, really. Maybe I'm just deluding myself. And that, you know, I think, you know, if you can do a 48-hour course before you start your own business or you start moving overseas, do that.
Yeah.
But it's, no, it's yeah, it's tough. It's really tough.
Let's go in a slightly different direction now. And this is not really to do with mental endurance, but it is to do with cultural sensitivity. And as a Brit operating in Australia and then operating back into other parts of the world, how important do you think cultural sensitivity is when you're doing business internationally?
Huge, absolutely huge. Don't mention the ashes. maybe not this year. We'll see another year. But no, I think it's huge. You've got to, The way you conduct business here in Australia is very different to how you conduct it in New York, which is very different to how you conduct it in LA, which is very different to how you do it in London. I would say, it goes back to my research piece, go the extra yard, learn the customs, learn the traditions, and speak to an American who's working in Australia. Speak to someone who's in Australia who comes from a country you're trying to get to. And bearing in mind, you can go in the States and one state to the next is very different. So, but you can get try as much information as you can around it that way. You've got to learn how business is conducted. There's a classic one in, you look at Asia, there's a very different way of entertaining people. There's a very different way of passing transactions to one another. So what I mean by that is effectively you don't rock up with your first page of a contract for them to sign. You might never sign something. It might get done down the line, but not up front. Whereas in the States, they might want to see you've done your homework and want it in a document. So it's really difficult. But it's something that I think you've got to be very cognizant of. And you've got to, I think if you normally go 100 miles an hour, you've got to go 60 miles an hour because you've got to keep a bit back to find out, I think personally, when people are going to a country to learn, I'm not talking about people divulging themselves massively into it, but if you're going to a country in Germany, for example, and you want to engender yourself to the people, learn how to say please and thank you, learn how to say hello in German. It doesn't take much. And if you make a mistake in it, they're not going to crucify you for it. It's just one of those things. But I think little things like that will help you build a lot of goodwill. And when you go to a new country, you need goodwill on both sides. As with any new relationship with new business contacts in Australia, for example, you need to do that. Where you can come really unstuck is culturally interpretations of law and interpretations of things that can really bite you. And I'm not talking about offending someone because you say the wrong thing. I'm talking more about there's a contract in French law. If you don't sign this contract, it means regardless of any other contracts you sign, it's not valid. So that's just an example. But those kind of things are incredibly important. And you're not expected to know that, but ask for help. But I think what I've seen is a little bit of arrogance, I suppose. Everyone's guilty of it. You do well in your own country. You want to expand somewhere else. You don't bother to take the rest of the information and around the edges in terms of business transformation and how that works. I think it's huge. It's definitely up there in probably the top three.
There will be some people listening to this podcast who are thinking about expanding their business internationally and wondering whether that's a realistic aspiration or just a pipe dream. What would you say to those people?
Well, personally, I love pipe dreams. So I think you can turn a pipe dream into reality. I think what I'd say to somebody is do your homework, be sensible about it, but don't write it off. You've got to be sensible with your timing with a business. If you have cash in the bank and you feel it's the right time, then have a look at the business you're going to move to. It might be fantastic for a given product in a certain country, but not in the country you're looking at. What is the reason you're trying to go to an international market? Is it scalability? I'll tell you why. I met somebody last week who said to me, "You're interested in taking you on to have a look at some work." And I said to him at the time, "You've got a great business here. I think you could do more here before you move. Why are you looking to move?" And it was literally, he gave me an example of a calculation and said, "There's X million people in New York. There's X million people in London. There's X million people in Madrid. I like those areas. I think I can make this much money by a year and a half." I was like, okay, so it's a pure scale thing. Oh, not really, I like Madrid as well. So it was I've been a bit facetious, but he was effectively saying, I like the idea, he wanted scale. So he thought if he could crack a part of the market in Europe or America, it would suddenly give him his following in Sydney, which has taken, Sydney, Melbourne it was actually was, but effectively it's taken him 7 years to get where he's got to in Melbourne. He was hoping to replicate this in a year and a half. Now, I'm all supportive for pushing as hard as you can, but you do have to do your kind of cultural investigations, how does business work there? And we'll probably do a bit of exploratory work with him to get to a stage where he's ready to go or not. And then it's a decision, but I would never say no to somebody to doing something. If I thought there's an inkling, a timing piece might not work. Obviously if you're selling something that only works in Australia and it's only applicable to Australians, then it might not work elsewhere, but
hats with corks maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you could probably sell a few of them in the Australian bars in London, maybe, or somewhere else. But it's tough. I think they're in a situation where you want to move overseas, you want to get the scalability. you might decide that, you know, your product's going to work very well. I would discourage people from listening to people who say no, particularly in the startup community. There's a lot of very resilient people who are thick-skinned, who have had a lot of no's. But I think you've got to really be sensible about what you're taking on if you're going to move overseas.
Justin, it has been absolutely super to talk to you today. If people would like to know more about what you do, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they're welcome to contact me directly on LinkedIn, Justin Hildage, or they can go to our website, which is thamescapitalgroup.com.au, which has a link there for what we do, and also you can get in touch with us there. Or you can contact me directly on my email, which is justin.hildage@thamescapitalgroup.com.au.
Fantastic. Well, I wish you all the best as Thames Capital keeps expanding, and I hope we'll have you back here on the podcast at some stage to tell us where you have gone with your going global plans.
Wonderful. Thanks very much.
See you soon.